Thank you very much. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me here. I've flown in Sunday morning. We had the conference yesterday, and I can clearly say that the gradient in weather is super, but the quality of talks and how I'm enjoying myself, my hair is even better. So I'm not a native speaker of English, as you can guess, but I think I've correctly chosen in my title the present progressive form. This is something we're working on now. So you will see a few things where optimal control results do work on superconducting qubits, and you will see a few things where we hope they're going to work soon. Work has been largely part of our IAPA-funded collaboration with John Martinez, previous speaker, and it's also part of a nice European network. And my definition of optimal control is the Yeson-Koch definition. So we're applying optimal control theory to achieve a certain task in our quantum system. So we've heard a lot about superconducting qubits in the last talk. I try to summarize what we think are the main ingredients you really need to understand for setting up optimal control and what the main challenges are. I talk a little bit about the tools we use. Almost none of them were invented by us. But as it often happens, you learn something that's completely general. You want to apply it, and you realize you need to still tweak it a little bit because it actually, it still needs to have more generalization. There will be a bit of show and tell of things that do work, that have been applied, certain control tasks coming naturally out of the first section. And then I'll talk about the big thing, which is taking a pulse out of numerical optimization that you potentially do not understand and apply it anyway. I will show where we are with that. And we will see that actually the main challenge in this is to do the tune-up of the pulses and the experiment properly. So superconducting qubits for control theorists. So if we start very simple with the linear LC oscillator, here is an oscillator potential with a nice parabolic shape, waveforms, and we have equidistant spacing. Now, at least in the traditional sense, this is not a qubit in the sense that you cannot just decide, I want to cut out two of my lowest energy levels and address those and somehow decouple from the rest because all these spacings are equal. And there's a theorem, any linear drive on a harmonic oscillator leads to coherent states, not to Fock states. And of course, there are workarounds how you can still, with single oscillators, do quantum information, but not in the sense of approximating a qubit. Now, this is why instead of the inductors, the quadratic potential of the inductor, we're using Josephson junctions. That's a nonlinear detector with a cosine-shaped potential where this symmetry is broken. And there's a whole variety. We've already heard about transmons. Here is an older plot from the Martinez lab on phase qubits. There's a variety how you can use these tools to make qubits. Now, it turns out the most popular, mostly for design and coherence reasons, of these qubits have an energy structure like this. That's also true for the transmons we've seen in the last talk. Here it's shown for a phase qubit, also because here you very nicely see what's been left of the cosine. So you're combining a cosine and an inductive potential, which means you're getting here two minima of your cosine folded into a parabola. And you want to work with computational states that are on the left well. Now, you want to make sure that even when you're in the excited state, you don't tunnel out, at least during operation. Of course, you want to tunnel out during measurement. So realistically, this well is quite deep. So it's not really unharmonic. You're working with states pretty deep in the cosine. So there is an unharmonicity in there, but it's small. So we are only slightly departing from this potential. And that is, in the modern superconducting qubits, that's a pretty universal feature. The second element is the resonators we have seen. So this is, again, a picture from John Martinez's lab. Here you see an architecture, which I think is the previous version of what John is working on now. It's called this version 0.9, which has a number of qubits and has a number of resonators. So here is a drawing made by Alexandre Blais. which shows that here's a strip line resonator with a standing wave mode. You're typically only interested in one mode of this resonator, and you're putting the qubit in the center. This can be used for connecting qubits, either in the sense of the bus, you put many in them, or in the sense of a smart car, you put a few in them. You can use this as memory. That's also an element we have to remember. So what implications do we have for optimal control? First of all, even though we want to look at qubit logic, we always have to deal with higher levels. Secondly, these are human-made systems. Say in Paul Jessen's talk and discussion afterwards, we have seen that this works so well because the Hamiltonian is known so precisely and because all atoms of the same isotope are identical, have identical properties. Here, there's very precise design, but ultimately there's a bit of fabrication uncertainty going on. It's a cryogenic setup, which means there's a lot of filtering involved. Here, you see a typical filtering tree in a dilution refrigerator, and I cannot explain all the details of this. Just if you're a theorist, you should be impressed by this, okay? It operates at microwave frequencies because superconductors don't superconduct at frequencies that are too high. Typically, because these are macroscopic objects, we can have inter-element coupling that's pretty strong. And what we want, what we're aiming at is a quantum computer, so we're aiming at unitary gates, not at state-to-state transfer, at least for the sake of this talk. So, there's been a lot of achievements, and these numbers get outdated while you walk from your chair to the front, but certainly long coherence times, quick gates, 2 and 3 qubit gates, algorithms, simple demonstrations of error corrections, and all kinds of non-classical states have been demonstrated. So the system is very mature, and we are at the point where optimal control theory, application of optimal control theory really makes sense. So what kind of tools are we using? We have, we started this when I was in Munich, so two jobs ago, and we started talking with Stefan Glaser's group, Stefan is here in the audience, and learned the GRAPE methodology. For those of you who are not into control theory, let me explain a little bit what the main twist is when you're setting up in optimal control, which is you want to optimize some performance index J, a suitably chosen fidelity, and the right choice matters, as we learned yesterday. And you, that is typically computed in the end of a time, and then you have time steps at which you can adjust your controls. And the main challenge is to see what happens if I wiggle here, what happens to the fidelity in the end. Now, the wrong way to do it is to wiggle here, which means to, you know, change it a few points, so numerically solve the Schrodinger's equation, and then take a numerical gradient. That's the wrong way to do it, because numerical gradients are one of the worst things you can do to your computer. What you really want to do is you want to move backwards. Change it, you know, if everything of this is preset, the effect of the last time slice on the gate can be readily computed. Then if we go one step backwards, we're taking the gate and we're propagating it back in time. So this is now set. Now what do I need to have here for things to work? Well, again, I can, you know, I'm not basically taking this as my last pixel and optimizing a backpropagated gate. That is very efficient, and on top of this, it's possible to calculate gradients analytically. So if you're using trace fidelity absolute square to be immune to global phases, you're time slicing the propagator, and you don't have to go through all the details of this formula. The main thing is that there exists an analytical formula that can be constructed iteratively. That makes the numerics very efficient. And that's, of course, published in this famous paper. Now, a bit of an improvement to this can be done by the BFGS method after its inventors. We learned this from this paper, but it's probably much older. And what you're doing there is instead of linearizing the landscape of your functional, you're actually including the Hessian, the second derivative matrix, and you are you want to minimize this functional based on including the Hessian. That gives you somewhat faster convergence, as you can see here. So that's what we use. An important thing to take into account is the filtering of the system. So basically, if, for example, this is what your optimal control algorithm has found, or what you're programming on your arbitrary waveform generator, this is going to get sent through filters that are there because it's a cryogenic system. Wires can have very funny transfer functions, and there may even be antenna involved, depending on how exactly you apply the microwaves. So basically what this means that, for example, if that's what you programmed, really the blue line is what's arriving at your sample, which is kind of interpolating. So if you're calculating gradients, it means when you're, for example, pulling at this control, you're influencing a whole bunch of finer grained controls in what's arriving at your sample. This can in general be under very generic assumptions, be described by a linear transfer function. So the output is an integral over the input, over the complete past to ensure causality. And essentially in Grape, this gives you, this filter defines you an additional transfer matrix, and we can readily implement this. And a lot of what I'm showing now is from the PhD thesis of Felix Motzoi, who was here in the audience. So this is the first adaptation for experiments we have to do. Now let's look a little bit at the task that we need to do. And this is the first thing we did in optimal control. You see back then we were writing on blackboards. This is a very early experiment with two superconducting qubits of the charge qubit variety, traditional charge qubits. And we were in Munich, we talked to Steffen Glaser's group, we started working with Thomas Schulte Herbrüggen. And what this is you have a Hamiltonian that is living in a Hilbert space spanned by charge eigenstates. So these numbers count the excess charges on qubit 1 and qubit 2. And the Hamiltonian has a component that's diagonal in charge space. And it's described by electrostatic charging energy. This is a system of coupled capacitors. So this is in general quite complicated. And Josephson terms that describe the hopping of a Cooper pair from here, the reservoir, onto the island, so that to change the charge quantum number by one. So if you're mapping this into a logical basis, you're looking at the lowest energy states, what you're getting is local Z terms that you can control, local X terms, and a ZZ interaction. So you just throw this into Grape, and that's what you get. What is interesting is that this is very fast. It's about 55 picoseconds. It's palindromic, which means if you read it backwards, it's the same. And that has to do with the fact that this system has global time reversal invariance. This Hamiltonian could be written with real numbers only, so it's time reversal invariant. And the controlled NOT gate we are aiming at is also its own inverse. And then it makes sense that there's a class of good solutions that's palindromic. The other interesting thing is that usually in optimal control, we think that for two qubit gate, the limiting factor is always the interaction. But here it's actually the EJ on the second qubit, the fact that in the controlled NOT we need to flip something because EJ is somewhat slower than the interaction. Now, you know, we were very proud of this result. We talked to experimentalists and said, hey, you can make a gate in 50 picoseconds. Everybody told us, well, you know, with the electronics we have, with the filtering we have, with the frequency constraints, we really don't want to do a gate in 50 picoseconds. That would be impossible and have other problems. So here is the first problem that actually found applications. So this is dealing with leakage. So here's again an energy level scheme of an unharmonic oscillator that typically describes a superconducting qubit. So here we have the 0 to 1 transition. This is where our qubit is. But then here is a leakage transition to a higher state that has a frequency that's lower by a factor of delta 2. Now, that problem has a couple of years ago been observed in both in Santa Barbara and in Yale. And here are two different ways to measure the error due to this, but they all have the same conclusion. Here's the gate time. And we see that a longer gate leads to a higher error. And that makes sense because you're limited by decoherence. So you get shorter and shorter and shorter, you have less and less decoherence, and at some point you have a turnaround. And that turnaround comes from the lack of nonlinearity in the system. So in a spectroscopic notation, what this means is that you have your transition between 0 and 1. You're coming in with a pulse that, for example, has a Gaussian envelope function, which is nicely limited in both time and frequency space. So it has a certain spectral width that's given by 1 over the gate time. That's a minus 1 missing here. So if you make this shorter and shorter, it gets wider and wider. And at some point, the leakage transition, which is slightly detuned, has some significant overlap with this pulse. And you're starting to get errors. There's phase errors that kick in even earlier that are a bit more tricky to explain. Now, the solution, this turned out, is envelope shaping, a strategy we call drag, derivative removal by adiabatic gate. And it looks like this. So this is what we found numerically. So here, we are looking at what happens if you can shape the envelope of your drive that is in resonant with the 0-1 transition. And that typically is a Gaussian. And in this typical strategy before that, this shape of the sine omega t of the phase-shifted component. So this would be in phase and quadrature in signal processing jargon. We assume we can also shape. And what we found is that if we started with a Gaussian, grapes spit out something that looks a little bit like a Gaussian. The outer phase component looked like this. And those functions are related. U2 is the derivative of U1. And it happens to be scaled by delta 2 by my frequency offset. The red line is a real-time frequency detuning, which I am going to explain in a minute. Now, this is what we, you know, this is 6 nanoseconds. And this has 100 points, I think. But then we looked at pulse generators that typically have 1 nanosecond time slices. And it turns, and we put that into our optimization and turned out that you still get a similar result. So the green line with the eyes of love is still the derivative of the blue line. And indeed, so that worked. It was interesting because we could later, and this will be the next two slides, explain this analytically. So this is CAD, computer aided discovery. And it survived going to low pixels, and this red real-time detuning could be removed. And indeed, both same two labs as on the last slide, it has worked. So you see here an improvement by using the drag technique in its half derivative variation, which essentially doesn't have this. Here you see a similar thing done by randomized benchmarking. So this has worked. But this has worked because we first ran the numerics, then we explained it analytically, and then experimentalists rebuilt the analytical result on their setup. So why do we have this derivative? Well, there is a classical argument you can have that only applies at weak enough drive. And that tells us that the excitation is essentially given by the Fourier transform. So if omega is our envelope, and we are detuned by little delta, which is the same as the capital delta of the last slide. And we have a complex envelope function, then the probability of excitation will be given by the Fourier transform. We can simply take this formula, integrate it by parts, and get an expression like this. And we see that this is zero if the imaginary part is given by the derivative of the real part. Now, you can see this in the spectrum, how this works. This is, you could call, narrow band spectral hole digging, which is very different from typical spectroscopic techniques where you want to suppress the spectrum at a broader range of frequencies. Namely, here, blue is your in-phase Fourier transform. The purple line is your derivative. And as a derivative, it has to be zero at zero frequency, which is very important because this way you're not messing with your resonant control. But off-resonant, if you take the right ratio, they exactly cancel. You, of course, need to know where you want them to cancel. Now, this is a classical argument that works at low, essentially unsaturated transitions. Quantum mechanically, what you need to do is you say, OK, I want an effective Hamiltonian in a toggling frame, in a time-dependent different frame that has the following properties. Well, this is always true, as has to be Hermitian. The first of all, it needs to get the gate right. So it needs to start and end at zero. Otherwise, the gate you're finding in the new frame is the wrong gate. Secondly, you don't want to have a leakage. So the effective Hamiltonian shouldn't have any matrix element at your unwanted transition. And it still has to be sufficiently non-trivial in your qubit subspace. That gives you an under-constrained set of equations for S. One of them were the results I've shown in the last slide. One of them were the half derivative or simplified drag technique where you don't have to have real-time detuning. We've now generalized this to the three-dimensional transmon case. For a three-dimensional transmon, one property is that in their purest and most coherent form, you have very little tunability in your qubit. So you have a high risk of frequency crowding. So a situation you can encounter is if qubit one is your usual three-state system, qubit two you may deliberately made different. But for example, the difference between the logical transition of qubit one and the Likert transition of qubit two could be extremely small. We've worked with experimentalists in Delft who reported they had a sample with this difference only being 90 megahertz, which is much less than this Likert transition we know how to deal with. We tried to apply drag and it didn't work. Why did it not work? Well, if you're take as an energy denominator here in your drag formula, capital delta, you're not killing your main problem, which is little delta. If you put in little delta, your U2 control becomes so big that perturbation theory approximations we have done before all break down. And indeed, numerically, here you see the solid line and the not so solid line are no drag and drag. You see drag has very little effect. Now, what you can do instead is you can say your in-phase component, instead of being a Gaussian, you give it a little bit of extra amplitude modulation. So this is just two cycles of a sideband modulation, and you still put the derivative with capital delta on your quadrature component, and that you can optimize these amplitudes using a Magnus expansion, and you see that at certain sweet times that are set by little delta, you're getting the gate really well if you allow that next to your x gate on qubit one, you also get a phase shift on qubit two, which you can always bookkeep for forever, and we can compute values of the error phase. Now, the really interesting thing is, if we take this to a computer, we get the same type of sideband modulation if we make the pulse long, but if we go shorter and shorter, the pulse becomes wild. But the interesting thing is that the fidelity does not drop. There doesn't seem to be a speed limit coming from the drift Hamiltonian for this at all. As long as you have enough parameters to optimize, you seem to be able to do this gate well. So the answer is, so if you're wondering the lack of flexibility in 3D transmons, what does it, how does it limit us? You can, one answer can be not at all, at least if you have infinite pulse shaping capabilities. So there's no principal limit, but there may be a practical limit because those wild pulse shapes are obviously extremely challenging. Now, one thing which is nice about optimal pulses is that they are quite robust. If you're at an optimum, then all your gradients are zero. So here from our paper, from our first paper, looking at timing jitter, and we see very nicely the optimal pulse is on what's up on a peak. So even with 5% error, we only get 5% timing jitter, we only get errors in the fourth digit. Similar things have been shown by Simone, who is here, who is now in Tommaso Caracco's group. Tommaso is also here, that this even works for immunity against very slow noises. If you want to take this further, you can take robust control if you're taking a cosine potential with a lot of tunneling between the welds, and you have these broad bands, you can do robust control. And this is a busy plot, you can ask me about this later, but you can get good fidelities if you do robust control with this. So this is kind of the muscle flexing of optimal control theory, but how would we make it work in experiment? So with drag, we were very lucky. We found a solution that we can understand and can adapt to experiments, but as we know that for complex gates, that is really not true. So here we're taking the zero, the last architecture from Translab, the rescue architecture, many elements of which are part of the new architecture also. And this is what we're aiming at. Here we have two qubits coupled to a cavity. The cavity starts in vacuum and it should end in vacuum. And the tuning knob we have is the frequency of the qubits. So different from Christiane's talk yesterday, it's not dipolar drive, it's, we are driving by frequency change. Here is the other qubit Hamiltonians with some unharmonicity. Here we have the typical James-Cummings coupling between qubit and bus and between bus and qubit. We want to do a controlled phase between qubits, so if we start in a logical state like this, we want to end up in a state where the cavity is empty again and we get a conditional phase shift. Now, what's the baseline? How would you typically do this? Well, the baseline you can understand by simply looking at the James-Cummings interaction that we have between qubits, both qubits and the bus, which conserves the total number of excitations. If you let this run for half a period, what this does is it I-swaps a single excitation from the qubit into the bus. So you're swapping it in, you're getting a factor of I. This I is important because if you're running it twice, and I messed up my factors of two here, you're getting an I swap squared, so you're getting a phase of minus one. So how is the pulse sequence, physical pulse sequence going? You started a single, you put the single excitation subspace on resonance. You I swap qubit one into the resonator. So if you have an excitation in qubit one, it will now be in the resonator. Then you're putting the two excitation subspace on resonance. That's slightly tricky, but it works. Slightly tricky because this is three-dimensional. And you're doing a conditional phase shift, very similar to the Dirac-Zoller gate and ion traps, which means the excitation goes from the resonator into the second qubit and back, and this minus should be outside, so you're getting a minus phase. But this only works if you actually are in the two excitation subspace. It only works if this excitation in the resonator that came from the first qubit is there, and if the second qubit is also excited. So this gives you a conditional phase shift, you I swap back. That's it. Now, this crucial step was very early explained by Frederick Strauch. So the C phase gate is a symmetric gate. There's no distinction between control and target, but how I just explained it, qubit swaps into the resonator, phase shifts the other qubit and goes back. This pulse sequence is asymmetric, and there's an interesting question where the optimal control solutions also have this asymmetry. Now, we shouldn't call them control and target, and the main thing has been involved by Fred Strauch, so we take another famous couple. So we take Ginger and Fred. So Ginger is the qubit that is going to be swapped into the resonator, and then the Strauch gate phase shifts Fred, and then Ginger is going to be swapped back. The authors of the paper still discuss whether we want to use this nomenclature on the paper. So this has three sequential steps, and you have to pay attention, it's limited by third level errors. The other thing we need to take into account is that the filtering is something that is perfectly reasonable but looks a bit extreme, but there's nothing wrong with it, which is that your time steps are 1 nanosecond and your filtering function is a Gaussian of 4 nanoseconds width. So you can really sculpt a smooth waveform by adjusting those pixels. So if you just run grape without any filtering, this is what you get. These are the frequency detunings for Ginger and Fred. So Ginger, Fred, it's not a three-piece sequence. They are all moved at resonance at the same time. So the three steps of the previous sequence are kind of executed simultaneously. Ginger is doing two I swaps in a row, and there's a bit of oscillation that corrects for the AC Stark shift from higher levels. Fred is also resonant, but there's a bigger excursion to, again, adjust for phase shifts. This is also a palindromic sequence for the same reasons as I explained above. Now, this is what comes out of numerics, and it looks very nice. It's 27 nanoseconds long. It's developed with a 4 nanosecond Gaussian filter. It assumes an interaction of 30 megahertz, and the pixels are 1 nanosecond in length. So that's pretty good. First step is, what does the filtering really do? So ideally, without filtering, we would like to have this type of pulse shape. That's just a small version of what we've seen before. If we optimize with filtering, we realize this is what you would need to program into the pulse shaper. And this is not palindromic anymore. Why? Well, the transfer function has causality. Causality breaks time reversal invariance. And what you're getting after the filter is still, is again, very, very smooth. So what's the challenge? You know, why am I not talking in the appropriate tense for the recent past? The challenge is to make this work an experiment is tune up. Remember, our control is that there's a voltage at room temperature that is going into this through filters into a nonlinear oscillator, and you are changing the frequency between the two lowest eigenstates of the nonlinear oscillator. And that is known very well in experiment, but it turns out because this is our main control, even small experimental uncertainties lead to relatively huge errors. Very easily, it can happen to you that you slightly undershoot or slightly overshoot, that you want these two red and blue lines to be really at the thick line. So that translation is more precisely, but not precise enough for the purposes of this pulse. So how would we debug this? Well, you can do this ad hoc. This is a simple enough system. So this is the fidelity landscape for phase errors for uncertainties in qubit 1 and qubit 2. You nicely see that our usual grape solution is at a peak. The problem is the peak is not very wide, and it's pretty steep. So here, these valleys, you're getting success probabilities that are actually close to zero. You're really doing things wrong. Now, the good news is if you measure the same probabilities, this was done in the Martinez lab, mostly with Daniel Sank, a PhD student in that lab, we are mapping out the same landscape. So we can now, in principle, say when we are here, we can go through this landscape, adjust parameters nicely. So we're at the peak, and then it should really work. And that's what we hope to achieve soon. Now, so what are the lessons learned? Grape pulses can work in superconducting qubits, but they don't right now. And the precise system characterization is extremely crucial. So we have done robust control on this system. It gave a tiny improvement, but didn't solve the problem. And it's mostly those nonlinear transfer functions. So we work on these issues. And one way how we work there, this is work in progress, is to say, well, if it's so difficult to characterize those things, let's avoid characterizing them. And we were inspired by what people are doing in optimal control and chemistry, pioneered by Herschel Rabitz, which is essentially self-learning. So what we do is we use a genetic algorithm, starting with a few good guesses in our landscape. We characterize the outcome, and we use a genetic algorithm to find better pulses. So it's very similar in spirit and very different in details from what we've seen before in femtosecond chemistry. Namely, these are genetic algorithms for unitaries, not for state transfers. And the initial guesses we have are pretty good. So we have optimized something. We're using the genetic algorithm on the last mile. However, so the good news is that this converges. We can get error rates that are very low. The bad news is the numbers on this axis. If you have 10,000 generations, and each of those involve a relatively long measurement run, that is difficult. So we are seeking out, and have heard actually on the shuttle yesterday, about methods to make this converge faster. Other methods to help with characterization is to measure your parameters quickly and precisely using Bayesian update strategies. That's through preliminary results by Yuval Sanders, who is also here. And it's based on works by Sophie Schirmer, by Howard Wiseman, by people from Waterloo, including Chris Ferry, who is here, and many others, to use Bayesian updates to learn parameters of the Hamiltonian. And the important thing here is, here we're inferring a coupling constant, we have very fast convergence, given that this axis is the number of shots of single measurement runs. Whereas in a typical run, you're computing your measuring expectation value. So for each data point, you have 10,000 points. We also try to use Bayesian methods for fast process tomography. Let me conclude. I hope I convinced you that superconducting qubits can profit from applying optimal control theory from them. But even though you probably haven't seen any fundamental innovations in optimal control theory, all the things you need to go through also benefit optimal control theory in the opposite direction. I think we've pretty much solved the issue of higher level leakage. So with very weakly anharmonic oscillators, we can still compute very well. I've shown you how to make fast gates of frequency quadrant 3D transmons. And I hope that I can convince you that the challenge in applying this is to close the loop between characterization and control. And I've showed you a few means how we do this. Thank you very much for your attention.
So we have time for a few questions. Just a second.
So it's more a comment about your slow convergence with genetic algorithms. Mm-hmm. We know about that because genetic is basically shooting in the dark, in the sense that, you know, you encode and in some funny way you reproduce what, you know, biological system would do. And Simone will explain that actually CRAB, we developed basically to overcome that, and it does converge much faster than that. And so it is something that we would be interested probably in using in your context.
Yes, one short comment is, so I'm curious to see this, but to point out what I've seen before in CRAB, which is probably not everything, is that this is optimization without a Hamiltonian. So, but I'm curious to see it.
Okay, so do you include modeling for decoherence in your optimization, or does it matter?
In this case, we have not included this. We have worked on including decoherence by single telegraph fluctuator in the past. The reason why we didn't include this is that most of the structured decoherence in this system is mitigated by the qubit design. So if you're working with a transmon and not with a 20th century Cooper pair box, the structured decoherence, the very sensitive dependence on the working point, is already gone. And for the unstructured decoherence, we at this point, let's say if we can do it quick, we will avoid decoherence. Now, whether there is a as our understanding of decoherence deepens, as we find new structure in the decoherence, that issue is very likely to come back. But it's not our main concern right now. Our main concern is to make it work and experiment.
Hey, Mike has a question.
I actually had a comment. It was relating, obviously, to our shuttle bus conversation.
Yes.
So I just wanted to advertise for the community a recipe that I did not invent. It is well known by civil engineers. It's called the Neldermead simplex method. And it works about 1,000, it converges in general in all the numerical routines we ran about 1,000 times faster than grape or any kind of gradient descent. It's extremely well documented, it's in numerical recipes, it's native to almost all freeware software packages. I get no credit for advertising it, but it just really works quite well.
So I had a question. In your pulse for the C phase, there's no difference between the two qubits, but your control pulses were different on 1 and 2.
Yes, so the control pulses, thank you very much for this question. The control pulses are different, and it turns out if the qubits have a different amount of nonlinearity, so if the detuning of the leakage transition is different from qubit to qubit, you want the one with the larger nonlinearity to be Fred, so the one that gets phase shifted through the cavity, and the one with the smaller nonlinearity to be Ginger, the one that gets swapped into the cavity. Typically, the optimization algorithm breaks that symmetry for you, otherwise you need to slightly seed it. And it's very interesting, when we were looking for symmetric solutions, we didn't find any. So with exactly symmetric setting, the system still wants to break that symmetry.
And is it possible to try and reduce the amount of local addressing by trying to put some penalty into how local the how homogeneous the pulses are between the two qubits?
That might be possible, but we have not done that yet. Our concern on making the pulses simpler is rather to reduce the degree of modulation by strong filtering, because that's the main concern for experiment. Whether that concern is a publicity problem or not is up to you.
Okay, well, if there's no more questions, let's thank Frank again for a very interesting talk. and we have a short break.